all gotten to know each other a little bit better in the last 24 hours. Phil Bailey is the Development Coordinator for Sustainable Harvest International. And for the last 10 years, he has been involved in fundraising for a number of different groups, as well as operating the Strategic Environmental Environmental Consulting Group. He was the Market Development Director for the National Recycling Coalition, and he founded the BioRecycled Business Alliance, which he told me a little bit about last night. Sounded very interesting. Yeah, you did.
Okay.
After the second beer. I've heard good things about you, Phil, and I've heard that you've got a pretty powerful speaking style, and I'm wondering if you want me to make everyone stomp their feet again.
No.
Okay. Without further ado.
Thank you again. Wow. Is it starting to like stop, right? Thanks for being here, and you know, we've been getting more specific as the day goes on. I'm going to take you back out to the macro, if you will, and put more of the human face on this. There we go. I don't read slides, so if you want to read them, go ahead. I'll make it brief for you. But this has been quite a journey that Sustainable Harvest has been on, started 9 years ago by a returned Peace Corps volunteer, Florence Reed, who saw the need for longer-term technical assistance. And I'm not going to spend any time talking about global climate change or our friends that it affects, except maybe these guys. When I was down in Panama last year, we got the opportunity to go on an island that's actually part of the Panama Canal. There are two lakes, and one of the islands has been run by the Smithsonian for some time, and it still is an original rainforest. And where two groups got to go on, both saw monkeys. I was not with the group that was greeted ceremoniously by some of the monkeys, and I'll leave you to guess how. The forests, as you probably know, in Central America, almost half of the forests have disappeared, due in large part to the traditional method of the slash and burn. And this is an example of a Mayan village in Belize who really depend on the forest for their building materials, for the livelihood. And for a number of decades, it all worked very well. 75 to 100 years ago, as Sophie indicated, slash and burn worked because they could leave a field fallow for 20 or 30 or more years, and it could regenerate. Population expansion, agricultural expansion, the changing political situation, the issue of land ownership has all led to more slash and burn more often. This is an example of it. Again, it works for two or three growing seasons. The problem is that the rain that we have today, yeah, we might get it for a day or two. They get it in buckets for 6 months out of the year with very little break in between the buckets. So the land becomes untenable for farming, and then they bring in these wonderful compaction machines, a lot of weight on little hooks. That treads it down even more, and eventually you get to the desertification. The thing that's interesting about this is that you think it kind of looks a little bit like it's becoming like a desert. It's not. It's hard as a rock. When you step on it, it's like stepping on cement. So you can imagine that growing here is absolutely impossible. It's also very difficult for the families that we work with. If you were here earlier today, you heard Nana mention that the average income is $500 to $600 a year. So I just kind of think about that for just a little bit, and what their choices are as the land becomes further degraded. They can either try and slash and burn, or they might go and try and use chemicals. However, this is, you know, we react to chemicals as, oh, it's bad, it's not organic, it's bad. Well, for them, sometimes it's the only way of holding on to their land. However, and here's the catch, for them, it's 1/3 of their annual income per year just to buy the chemicals. It's a no-win proposition. Usually the head of the household, which is often the man, might go to work on a larger farm, monoculture, plantation, whatever, but they'll be gone for 2 to 3 weeks at a time. Or they might try and move the whole family to a large city in their country. That's a no-win, because at best they're going to be working in sweatshops, they're uneducated, it's not going to work. Or, final choice, a family member tries to make it to the United States, and that becomes part of what some people here perceive as another problem. But for them, it is the last choice. It's 6 months to a year to even get here. And then, if they happen to find, if they get a service sector job or an agricultural job, and they're sending money back, they're still separated from their family. And their family is the core of their existence. The family structure is absolutely central to their lives. If they happen to be a woman trying to come, they have an equal chance of being beaten, raped, and left by the side of the road trying to get to the U.S. So, what we do is we help them to stay. This is one of the things, this is one of the outcrops of what we do. We started 9 years ago at zero. We're now in 4 countries, Panama, Nicaragua, Belize, and Honduras. We're working in 90 communities with now almost 900 families. So this is going from zero in 9 years to where we are today. One of the first things that we do is help them make the transition to sustainable techniques. What you're looking at here is just a planting of legume cover crops under their staple crops. They grow corn and beans. Almost if some people grow beans and corn. That's it. It's all grown at the same time, harvested at the same time, and they get the same low price. So we help to stabilize the soil. This is an example. This field right here had been degraded. It had been totally invaded by an invasive weed. And let me tell you that an invasive weed there makes ours look like ordinary, everyday, pull it out and it's gone weeds. It's entirely invasive. What we did there is actually a combination with the water project. We came in and flooded the land. The land was then tilled, planted a rice paddy, introduced fish into the rice paddy, which is, I think if you were here earlier, you're here, that it fertilizes the rice, the fish eats the insects, and in this particular case, or in most of the cases, the yield on the rice increases 400 to 800%. 90% of the families that we work with, when we start working with them, do not have their own vegetable garden. Such a simple thing. And nutritionally, they're very challenged. Kids are losing teeth at the wrong time. It's difficult for them. So this is one of the first things that we do. And the secret to our program is right here. You don't get to look. I don't know if you know that. The secret to our program is we work with local agricultural extension agents. We've really recreated the county extension agent system here. They work with 6 to 7 communities at a time, up to 10 families in each community, and they visit them a week or two, depends on the locations, a week or two. And each time they're sharing a new sustainable technique. It is all organically based, and the progress that is made is quite significant. This is one of my favorite guys, not only because he's happy with the carrot, but if you look, you can see the difference already. You see the difference in the soil. One of the wonderful advantages is that the opportunity for mulching and composting and so forth is outrageous. It's a lot of mulch. One of the second things that we do is we start replanting the rainforest, literally. We now have over 1,700 tree nurseries in Central America. It took us 6 years to reach 1 million trees, and I'm talking trees that are planted. We have an 85% retention rate on the trees. And it's only taken us 3 years, and we're almost at our second 1 million trees. So and the trees become a significant part for them. One example of which is this alley cropping. You can kind of see there's a kind of a little bushy thing growing in between the tree, in between the corn. That's one of the nitrogen-fixing trees that actually bring nitrogen up to the surface. It grows 10 to 20 feet a year, so they actually cut it back twice a year and use the wood for fencing and for fuel. The farmer told us that this was the first year, look at the mulch on the ground, this was the first year that the corn had ever grown taller than he. One of the other things we introduce as we're introducing the trees is multi-story cropping, with the hardwood trees eventually growing above the bananas and the plantains. Underneath that, depending on where they are, might be the shade coffee, the shade cacao, ginger, peppers, different crops that can be there. And so now we're talking about getting into the crop diversification, which is critical. I should let them know, this is from Belize. Simple sharing of appropriate pruning techniques increases the cacao yield 70%. And in Belize, actually there's a green, this shows you the upstream capability. Almost all of the crops are sold in local or region where they are, but in some cases, like cacao and coffee, we do try and find a way outside of the country. This cacao, dark organic, it becomes part of dark organic chocolate, which, by the way, is essential to life. My bag downstairs, I never go anywhere without chocolate.
Staple crop.
But they, there's a Green and Blacks brand that's an English brand, and they have one of their sub-brands is called Maya Gold, which is an orange and dark chocolate that has cacao from SHI families.
Maya Gold.
It's
really
like
good.
Orange and chocolate, pretty good. An example of this kind of cooperative is cropping is, you see the tree with a vine growing up it, that's a cedar tree with a vanilla bean vine growing up it, and it was interesting to hear Sylvia talk about this before. For us, we saw the rise in organic vanilla beans go up to $71 a pound, which is wonderful for them, and then it fell to 21 and now $12 a pound, but still, that's just based on supply and demand. Each of the extensionists works in their local and region to look at crops and what will sell well. In this particular case, onions was identified, so now we're diversifying the crops, but the border is mustard greens. And I gotta tell you, mustard greens grow 2 to 3 inches a day. You can almost sit there and watch them. I mean, it's just amazing. And the thing is that not so much that they're another crop, but the insects that would like to eat the onions like mustard greens more. So they all go to the mustard greens. It doesn't really bother the mustard greens because they grow so much. Our extensionist here is, I think it's kind of for show, but he's buying some of the mustard greens from our family farmer. More significant, in the background there, you can see some land that had been slashed and burned in the past. This is the same land now looking directly behind. These are three families who are working this land together, and they're just picking it up to show you how it has been enriched. Behind them is where they would have gone to slash and burn if they hadn't been able to save their land. Instead, that's now a shade coffee plantation.
Where is that?
That one is in Honduras. Here, this is just an example. Once we get into the third year, we're starting cooperative marketing. We're starting microenterprise lending, community loan funds. This could be as simple as getting people together and renting a truck so they can actually get their products to market and not have to carry them for 10 or more miles. This is one of my favorite guys, Don Cheo, who actually now has graduated from our program. We now have over 100 graduate families who no longer work with us because they don't need to. But one year, we had identified Tabasco peppers as a crop, and he planted some, and then the next year, when I saw him, he had planted more. And I asked him, I said, Don Cheo, I said, planted more peppers? He said, yeah. Well, that's the kind of answer that you often get. It's a little bit like, and we're trying to get, you know, quantifiable information, but it's a little bit like teenagers here. How was school today? Fine. What'd you do? Stuff. Where are you going? Bobby's. Yeah. But, so we're constantly trying to quantify, but the answers are often not always coming. So Don Cheo, I said, so how'd you do with that crop? He goes, you know, Felipe, before SHI, I was the best farmer in the area. Some years I made $900. I said, Don Cheo, absolutely. You are one of the best farmers. It's why we wanted to work with you. But tell me, how'd you do? So he looked around to make sure no neighbors were listening and said, I made $4,000. Then he told me that meant that his wife got medical care that she had needed. It meant there was going to be a new roof under, you know, they have two-room concrete cottages. His children were going to school in new clothes, and with this crop, he was going to buy additional acres so that his family could stay. So now we're talking about stability, we're talking about hope, and we're talking about opportunity. I'm going to quickly go through some of the ancillary items that we do, but I've got to tell her story as well. This is a woman who started a women's cooperative. They grow medicinal herbs, they do some intermediate processing on them, and she told me, she said, you know, my husband's a good man, he doesn't beat me. Definition of a good man, right there. But she said he never included me in any family discussion about money or anything. But I was the one who told him he should join this program. I was the one who got us involved. Now I'm bringing money into the family, and now we sit down every month or so and talk about things. So now we're talking about not only the environment and the economy clearly working together, but also we're talking about a social equation that is happening. Another thing we do are Lorena. This is an example of Lorena stove. You can see on the walls, the common cooking practice is an open fire right in the cottage. These are all stoves that can be made with locally available materials. We're also making starting to use a new stove, especially in Belize, a Justa stove, which uses 75% less firewood. This uses 50% less firewood, but all the smoke gets vented out. That smoke, when it's on the inside, is 4 to 8 packs of cigarettes a day. Chicken coops. The chickens, by the way, are unbelievably big and beautiful, but they get eaten by predators at night. So chicken coops are a good idea. This is another wonderful project. These are biogas digesters. Primarily animal waste and some other waste goes in. There's actually a bucket in the middle, half full of water. The pipe comes out. It's where the methane gas gets forced out, goes to a cook stove, and this woman told us that this was amazing for her because she thought that only rich women in cities ever got gas stoves. The extensionists also work with school groups, so the kids do a garden at home, they're doing it at school, and what I noticed the last time I was down on a service group tour, it was the kids who were showing us what to do. So now we're talking generational transfer. We do smaller world service programs. You can actually go down and work. In this case, they're preparing a field for a rice paddy, and that would be a college group. Notice the farmer in the back is oblivious and work. So I'm going to quickly give the accomplishments to date. And these are all things we've been able to quantify. 6,000 acres of degraded land that's been converted to sustainable usage. So there's a conservative factor of 5 that we're applying. 30,000 acres been saved from slash and burn. more than 1,900,000 trees planted. I'm just gonna, we started 2 years ago, we partnered with a group called Trickle Up, started with $10,000 in seed capital in community loan funds. So these are now being run by the community. Farmer can come, borrow $30, plant cabbages, give back, get $300 for the crop, and give back $32.50 or $33 back into the community loan fund. And that's now, actually it's even higher than that, but that's in 2 years, that money has doubled over. So we're doing microenterprise lending, all kinds of things are starting to come out of this. This is the technical assistance that's being provided. I'm gonna skip through the, this was a water project that we worked on with the Rotary Club, gave us $3,000 for the water project. It actually only took $2,000. We gave them $1,000 back. They were so shocked, they gave us another three. Just gonna finish by saying this is what our work cost, but I'm just gonna, and I'm not here today to ask you for money, but it's for a comparison. Average for one extensionist, including all the materials, salary, benefits, travel, everything, runs about $15,000 a year, and yet they're working with 6 to 7 communities. They're saving hundreds of acres each year, planting thousands of trees, and if you put that into climate change here, I mean, you could put solar panels on a house. It's quantifiably different scale that we're working on. That's it. Thank you very much. I tried to finish. Come from a variety of sources, not the least of which is agricultural colleges, so students who are graduating. We've started a paratechnico program where they're paired with an extensionist, and then they might choose to continue on to be an extensionist, all the way from people who have their degree in agriculture, some of whom have worked in it for 25 years, but they haven't worked with sustainable techniques, but we train them. And then including farmers who have worked with us and are particularly rather adept and good at communication, they might become extensionists. Our work is entirely predicated on theirs. And our goal, which I didn't get into, is to empower our countries that we're working with in partnership organizations to form their own NGOs, and eventually provide at least a portion of their budget, which then allows us to move and expand, because there are nonprofits in Guatemala, El Salvador, even Africa, who want to replicate this system. Thanks. Oh, I'm gonna pass around, I'll just start it. I'll start with Eric.
Yeah, hi.
It sounds like you work with families primarily, rather than the unit that you work with is a family unit rather than a community or a cooperative.
No, we do work, we help form cooperatives, but a lot of the areas I didn't take the time to get into are rather remote. There might be 6 or 7 families that we're working with, but they're spread out at quite a distance. It's not always possible to group them. But there are areas where there might be 8 families that are working together. So it really just depends on the situation. In Nicaragua, the area that we're working with is a 5-hour boat ride followed by a 6-hour mule ride just to get there.
Right.
So some of the areas are quite remote. But it just depends. I mean, we're in different regions.
I was just wondering if working with individual families, if you were working with, say, 3 families in the community, what the dynamics would then be for the families who are working with those
farmers? Well, it's interesting, because when the program first started, the extensionists would go to the community. This is a radically different way of doing things than what they've always known. They've known what their father knew and what their grandfather knew. I mean, this is what's known. So the extensionists used to go try and get some families together and say, here's what we're working on, here's what we're trying to do. If you would put 1 acre, we will show you that this technique works and that your economic life will improve. just through word of mouth, almost exclusively through word of mouth, we now have more families and more communities waiting to work with us than we're even working with. Nana made the mistake of going on the radio in Belize. We got 200 inquiries just off of that. So we need to have more extensionists, but we no longer need to ask. We're at the point where we're, you know, it's kind of a tough situation for us because we don't want to say no, but we can't say yes to everyone. Some of our graduates are indeed helping their other members of their family, so there is kind of also an organic spread to this. Aaron?
One thing that really struck me about all the agricultural techniques that you're describing is that they seem to be drawn from many different sources, the water meadows and the rice paddies with the fish and the coppicing and things like that. Some of them, those techniques have roots that go back really, really quite far in terms of farming techniques. And so I guess I was just curious where your agricultural extension agents got those techniques from, how you decide which techniques to encourage, and what's going to be appropriate for different localities. Because it seems like it could be quite a complicated decision between different methods.
I don't know if it's really complicated, and I'm probably not the best person to answer this, so perhaps Nana, you could.
Yeah, the fact is that we have institutions which have done a lot of research in terms of what is good for all of us, and one of these institutions is at the University in Costa Rica, where we do take our extensionists for further training. We do also invite researchers who have come across the different techniques, which we read and try to see how good it is. We invite them to train our extensionists to carry on that. And also, if there is one of the issues we as Sustainable Harvest International take into consideration is that every problem that comes up, we embrace it as an opportunity to challenge it. And that gives us the feedback and more research into things to find better solutions for our extensionists to learn and apply it in the farms and as well as with the participants who are working with them.
We also have a demonstration farm in Honduras, where we can gather extensionists and they share techniques also with each other. That's one of the other, I didn't show those slides for a little lack of time, but that's a new thing for us as well. Good.